Welcome back to the Transform Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Powers. In today's episode, we return to the world of the first century and try to discover how the early church exploded upon the Roman Empire so quickly. Matt's guest today is Steve Gladden, who is currently the pastor of small groups at Saddleback Church in Lake Forest, California, where he oversees over the development and expansion of over 3,500 small groups. Gladden, a quick, energetic, and passionate personality, loves working with people in small groups and teaching individuals and churches the foundations of growing relationships within those same groups. Today, Matt and Steve talk about how to create healthy small group communities in your church and launch people into vibrant, balanced ministry. They'll explore Steve's new book, Small Groups with Purpose. We know you're going to enjoy today's interview. So without further ado, let's listen as Matt talks with Steve about the phenomenal success of small groups at Saddleback Church and how those secrets can impact your ministry. It's all yours, Matt.
Well, thanks, Mike. I'm here at Saddleback Church with my friend Steve Gladden, and we just want to say welcome to the podcast, Steve.
Oh, thanks. You know, Matt, it's great to be with you. It's always fun just to, see what you're going to pick out of my brain.
Well, as a disclaimer to our listeners, I want everyone to know that Melody and I have been members at Saddleback for the last 5 years. I've been a small group host for the last two, and Steve and many of his staff have trained Melody and I in small group leadership, and I'm here to tell you that Steve's the real deal, and the stuff you find in this book and in this interview that he shares is authentic, and that's why I wanted to bring this to you. So, Steve, why don't you take a minute and introduce yourself to our audience?
My wife, Lisa, and I have been married 22 years on June 17th, so it's great just to be a survivor. have two kids, Erica and Ethan. Erica is going to be 13 this summer, and Ethan is 10. Was raised in a good home, a moral home, quasi-moral, but was raised in a Roman Catholic background. Went to a church that, or a parish, I should say, that didn't exercise the gospel as much as it could. Some of it could have been in Latin, and I couldn't have understood it, but, hey, that was it. But it was more about, just what my parents did out of rote than out of a relationship. And so, but it was my sister who got invited to a small group, and they didn't probably call it that back then. But she found Christ as a living Savior, a risen Savior, ended up coming back home and basically infiltrating the home with the gospel. So my mom got saved, and I got saved to that. I remember like it was yesterday in the den of our house, and she asked me if I wanted to be a follower of Christ. I didn't know what it meant, but I just knew I wanted what she had, and that started my journey. My dad came to know the Lord. I had three siblings, three older brothers who were out of the home. Two of them have come to know the Lord and all their kids, and so so just as way of introduction, the reason why this ministry lives and breathes is because I'm a byproduct of it. Mm-hmm. So, and grateful because my destiny I'd probably be somewhere in the business world getting wrapped up in things that I shouldn't have be getting wrapped up in. Hmm. So,
well, this is an excellent book and we're going to get into it in a minute, but, talk to us a little bit about your journey with God that led you right here. You've said a little bit about that. Let's talk about how you got to Saddleback through that process. You've come to Christ. And then take us from there to now you're at Saddleback.
Yeah, it was a bumpy road at that. Between my junior and senior year in high school, felt called to the ministry. But being a first-generation Christian and having no compass to know what that meant, I just, relied on my own insecurities and rationale to justify what I could and couldn't do. And so when I looked at what churches were doing, that wasn't what I was about. So have enough of that Catholic fear in me, I wanted to honor God. So I went ahead and went into my undergraduate, looked at some Bible schools, and to be honest, the ones that I looked at just weren't producing what I thought was me. And so that kind of left me stumped, like, God, if you're calling me into the ministry, and I go to a couple Bible schools that produce ministers, but it was just everything I didn't like. And so it was, I didn't know what to do. So I went into a liberal arts school in Springfield, Missouri, and took a major in biblical studies, just to at least honor God. At that time, I kind of got wrapped up into a cable company that was on the ground floor, which felt more like a natural environment for me. And so I actually was in there for my ground floor my freshman year. So for through my 4 years of undergraduate, I increased my hours where I ended up working full time for them.
Wow.
And going to school, which kind of killed the social life, which is probably good because that keeps you out of trouble. So if you're, you know, idle hands sometimes can go bad places. So, I had a Christian GM there named Jerry Rutherford who was instrumental in ways he probably doesn't know. But I can remember, thinking of what was security for me. And I had a job full time and I was making more money than I'd ever made before. And actually, I'd pay vacation. So when school's on break, I would actually get paid for it. And or when finals week was in. So it was one of those things that, you know, I thought, you know, I'd arrived. So in that standpoint. But he came to me and he said, I don't think this is God's purpose on your life. I don't think this is God's destiny for who you are. I can't make that decision for you. He goes, I won't fire you, so don't think that I'm going to hold that over you. But he goes, I don't think this is the road God wants, which led me to apply at Fuller. So so rewinding, you know, I'm not very scholastically minded. My concept of a preacher was you had to talk in front of people, which is good. You had to write and you had to read. All three of those I never had done. So, when I went to Evangel, my undergraduate school, you know, I got in on academic probation. So it followed suit when I applied to go to Fuller. I got in under academic probation once again. But it moved me westward out to Pasadena, California. And that's where I, you know, produced my, not produced, proceeded with my Master's of Divinity, which ended up about 2 years into that. You got to understand, you know, as a dog returns to its vomit, as the proverb says, I jumped back into a cable industry as soon as I got out to California. Only this time I had a GM who didn't like me. So for about 2 years, I kind of wrestled and led me on a lot of different journeys. But about 2 years into that road, when I was feeling like this guy hates me, he's making my life miserable, my pressures for doing academics was, you know, becoming harder, so I had to spend more time. And at the same time, my academic advisor was meeting with me. He goes, you know, you gotta actually work at a church if we're going to give you a master's. So I was like, oh, it just was the worst thing to hear. And so many things were coming on top of me that ended up quitting that job. It's the only job I've ever quitted. So that got me into my first church being a junior high pastor, or I should say a senior high pastor at that time. And a buddy of mine at Fuller kind of was already on staff at the church. He got me in starting on an internship. So that kind of got my feet wet into ministry. It was 10 hours a week. And as you read the book, you'll see that we have this principle with the disciples, you know, follow me and die for me, that, you know, that it's a gradual progression. And God was taking me through that same crawl, walk, run experience without me even knowing it. Was at North Hollywood and as a youth pastor and had worked, been on five different church staffs or four before I jumped over here to Saddleback. But it's interesting, on the third church that I worked with, I did more in the adult education piece and small groups were really part of it. And to rewind a little bit, in my earlier ministry, I did small groups because I was trained in it at Fuller, but it's more of a Paul Youngie Cho cell model. Mm-hmm. And it just didn't work for me. But what it did give me was I knew when I broke the numbers of kids down, I had less opportunity for chaos and, mischief to happen. So I did small groups more out of strategy. And the same thing, you know, when I was a singles pastor, did the same thing. I was doing it more of a system just to, you know, I just knew I could have an event every night of the week with singles. So that's why I was using small groups. But I was finally at this one church and, the small groups were really taking off. It was a younger church. And I discovered that I could actually use them strategically because now I'm in charge of adult education and how do these things all work together? So that was really my first step. And I'll never forget it because one of my buddies, who I actually give credit to in the book, he said to me, have you ever considered being a small groups pastor? And at that time, you know, you had a maybe a an associate pastor, and you had a youth pastor and a music pastor. Those were the staples in every church. And I thought, no, why would I jump into something like that? Because I want to have a job.
Yes.
And so, and even for him, I wasn't a small groups guy, but, you know, we had 70 groups of a church in, you know, roughly about 1,000. So it was something that was working well. And that kind of started the process where the next church I was at, I was actually, ironically hired as a small groups pastor there, which is all I did full time, at the last church before Saddleback. And then, you know, it brought me to Saddleback. So
tell her, most people, when they think of Saddleback, they think of a large church, but they probably don't, because they haven't been here. They don't catch the, we're going to talk a little bit later on about how about small groups really drives the church. Why don't you share just a little bit about, give us a real quick overview of what you oversee at Saddleback.
In our paradigm, we kind of frame everything on the Great Commission and the Great Commandment. And in that, I kind of oversee discipleship, where Rick uses two pictures, a baseball diamond and concentric circles, to help show the process of the church. And so I oversee second base in the baseball diamond picture, of being able to say, you know, what is discipleship? You know, how do we bring them in, then build them up before we train them for and send them out? And then in the concentric circles, how do we take people from just being someone in our congregation to someone who is committed to be a follower of Christ? So on that, in second base, I kind of oversee two buckets, if I could say, individual growth, which is, if you just look at discipleship, how do we cognitively help people at Saddleback Church grow their cognitive side in there? And then there is, so it's the individual health, and then there's group health. And the group health is overseeing the how do groups holistically balance or bring into harmony the five biblical purposes. So with that, we're kind of like the stock market, but anywhere between 3,500 and north of 4,000 adult small groups in over five counties in 173 cities and in 12 different languages. They kind of work at trying to say, how do we get the Great Commission and the Great Commandment into all the people at Saddleback?
And that's the basis of small groups with purpose, is you have learned so much, not just in theory, but so practically, what doesn't work, what works and what doesn't, what works better. And that's why I'm so excited about this book, is because it's biblical, it's solid, but it's not theoretical. It's very practical and it's very practicable. And I'm very excited about that. So let's talk about
that. As I was going to say, just even in that, with that, it's, you know, I've been at Saddleback 14 years and many of these concepts have been bubbling up. So, you know, as with all things, it's one thing to have a great idea. It's another thing to see an idea out for over a number of years to say, hey, does this practically fit and work? And the same thing for something that doesn't work. Was that just a fluke, or is it something that continually doesn't work? So easily over, you know, the last 20 years of, you know, giving and taking with different small group things, you quickly do learn that, you know, that it's over time. Now, could the book have come out 7 years ago? Sure, but it wouldn't be half of what it is right now, because some things were theory 7 years ago. Some things worked, and some things proved not to work. So, anyways, just to underscore your point there.
And one of the things that we notice in the book, you come back to from time to time, you realize that Saddleback's very large, but you give us practical help at every stage of the journey. And that's, again, part of what you've learned over time, and you've learned how to show us how to adapt this material, so that if our church is 100 or 1,000 or 10,000, or even if it's as big as Saddleback is with 22,000, 25,000, you've showed us how to do that practically, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, all the things in the book are very principle driven. There are methodologies, and some you'll read and say, oh, that won't work for our church, or, you know, you're too scared to try it in your church. You know, one of those two things. I'd encourage you to face fear, if that's it. Try something different. But the great thing is that they're all principles. Things that I did at a church that when we were under 200 would work just as well as when you have a church that's over 20,000.
Well, you talk about very early on, you talk about the five questions you're gonna deal with here. Let's talk for just a minute. This book deals with five basic questions. Why don't you just share them with our audience?
Yeah. Basically, the five questions are, you know, what does a healthy and balanced small group look like? Again, if you don't know where you're going, you're not going to be able to get to your intended destination. And it's kind of like in traveling. If you don't know where you don't have the address, your GPS can't nail down where you're going. So we want to know what is a healthy and balanced small group. And then what does it look like? You know, it's one thing to know where you want to go and, you know, what you want to see in a person. Then how should it look? You know, what are some of the basic constructs of what that should be? And we kind of look to the Bible for that. And then step by step, how do you do this? You know, that's a little bit more of the pragmatic is of where we're getting into a lot of the nitty gritty. Someone who's doing the ministry in their church is going to appreciate that much more than someone who's more of a theorist or just, you know, kind of an onlooker. But, you know, this book is totally, it's in the dedication. It's to the small group point people at every church. They're the unsung hero. They're never seen on the weekend. They are never wowed by numbers, but they are constantly in the trenches doing it. So this chapter is a little bit more for them. And then what's this mean for the overall church strategy? Because, you know, the strategy is what helps you get to your intended destination. And I look at a couple different things there. One is, you know, the delivery systems that a church has, Sunday school or small groups. You know, those are the two delivery systems. I'm not hung up on small groups or Sunday school. I'm more hung up on health. So I want to be able to say, you know, wherever you're at, let's partner up and figure out how do we get the Great Commission and the Great Commandment as the foundation instead of generally most churches, some with small groups, some with Sunday schools. It's more about the programmatic side of it than being strategic on it. And then, you know, going into some other fundamental things that we've learned at Saddleback that I think would help churches get people on that journey of moving strategically towards that destination. And then actually my favorite chapter out of writing all of it was, you know, do I have what it takes? Because there's it's a chapter that has nothing to do with small groups, but has everything to do with small groups. It's things I wish someone had told me from the very get-go. I always get asked, you know, hey, if you could rewind the clock, what would you do? And that's what that chapter is about, because that's what I wish I would have done if I could rewind it all.
Hmm. Well, it's a great book. And when I started it off, a lot of people who are maybe just have heard about Saddleback may deal with a startling statement you put right at the beginning of the book. And you say this: size is not indicative of health. Now, coming from a very large church, that's an amazing statement. Talk to us a little bit about, I mean, that's something as a small group leader, constantly we hear. It's something we've been trained time and time again. It's part of the DNA of Saddleback. It's part of the DNA of this book. Talk to us a little bit about the issue of health and why that's the key issue, not numbers.
Yeah. And, you know, basically part of that is just because I've seen it to be true, because it so often in church cultures, and I talk to so many small group point people that have to deal with this, you know, and rightfully so, church wants to know how many groups it has and how many people are in the groups, and do you take rosters on that? And sometimes there's a saying that says you measure what matters. And so a lot of times in our churches, without saying it, we can say the numbers are more important than what's actually happening. Mm. And so often you focus on trying to get more numbers than actually building up an infrastructure that is good. It's kind of like in a city that if you build a lot of homes, you can say, wow, I got lots of homes. But if you don't have the infrastructure going, it's going to turn into a very chaotic environment if it doesn't have a roadway system, if it doesn't have a sewer system, electric, and you know, things like that. So you can't grow it to something more of what you would like. And in all five churches that I've been a part of, with the exception of probably the last two, you know, we focus more on health because it's going to last the long haul. And to the guys that have and the gals that have smaller churches, I've learned, you know, at some of the mega churches I've been on staff at, is that, you know, the only one that likes big churches is the senior pastor, or the staff. And But people generally are just looking for a solid connection. And that can happen in a church of 20, a church of 200, a church of 2,000, a church of 20,000. But so often, you know, our staffing gets more around the stuff that's easily measured. And so that's why I took a crack in the book, as you saw, and throughout all of Saddleback, of trying to get us down looking more at, you know, do we have people working on spiritual health? And we have groups working on health versus, you know, just keeping track of numbers. So the numbers are important. There's no doubt about that. But so often we neglect the other side, and the pendulum is all the way over on the more hard numbers and rosters and things like that versus spending as much time, if not more, on spiritual health.
Well, and this book has tremendous resources, plus there are more web resources, plus there's so much more. I know that when we went through our first health assessment, that was enlightening because the questions are very specific, and they deal with where is God really working in my life, where is God really working in the lives of our small group members. Tremendous value. It's so valued. If you buy the book just for the issue of the health, You've gotten more than your value. This is amazing value.
And just even that little thing, the reason why that's so important is that so many assessments, I've seen them, and they're very, the thing that Rick has taught me is that simple is not superficial. Just because it's simple doesn't mean that it's bad. And so often we in churches, we create thick manuals for our small group leaders and you know, thick processes. And simplicity is really, a servant to the people of your church. And the assessment is just to challenge people to find one spiritual step. Do I want more? Oh, wholeheartedly. Yes, I want more. But I know if they don't take one step and are successful, I'll never get the other parts. So it's kind of like your children. You know, you want a lot of your kids by the time they're 18, but you're not trying to jam it all into them into the first year that you have that child. Well, you're just trying to build a foundation and try to build a relationship. So all that, sorry, detouring you on
that.
No,
that's
on
okay. That's fine. Because that really deals with one of the core issues that makes Saddleback small groups work better than a lot of other models, and that deals with the crawl, walk, run issue that you've already intimated. Talk to us for just a moment about crawl, walk, run and how that works in what we've just been talking about.
Yeah, it's one of those things that I really stumbled upon with my daughter because when Eric was growing up, I was noticing that, as a dad, sometimes you can push your kid too much, and that's a delicate, delicate line. But I found out that when I gave her, crawl steps, didn't call it crawl back then, but I knew when I started with certain steps, and I could get her to have a win, I would get more momentum behind her, willing to take another step. And so, like all things, it's biblical. You know, when it's truth, you can find it somewhere in the Bible. And sure enough, when you look at throughout the Bible, whenever an opportunity comes, you got one or two routes you're going to go. You're going to go towards risk, or you're going to go towards fear. Obviously, the enemy wants you to go towards fear because he doesn't want you to take a risk. You know, you're going to read things in this book, and the enemy's going to love you right where you're at. So that's why I encourage people to take a risk. And but when you take a risk and you're successful, you are successful, then it builds your faith. And when your faith is built, then the next opportunity you approach. And in that risk factor, that's where the crawl, walk, run are so very important to have, because when you make that risk step winnable, the confidence is built so that you can challenge them. You saw that in the life of David when you talk about that in the book, that the first, crawl step God gave him was 10 sheep. But yet, as you fast forward through his life, through a lot of incidences that happen in 1 Samuel, you'll see that it leads to in Psalms when he gives him the nation of Israel. That's a long way from being shepherding sheep to shepherding the nation of Israel. So something that was learned personally, but applied, as much as we can corporately.
It's one of my favorite quotes in the Bible. Kill the lion and kill the bear, and I'll kill this uncircumcised Philistine as well.
That's true,
Wow. You're adamant about the fact that small group ministry is and has to be built on basically the book of Acts and the methodologies that we learn in the New Testament. Talk to us a little bit about that, the biblical basis for small groups, because there is still raging in the debate about small groups is, are they biblical? Mm-hmm. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think it's just clear. I mean, obviously, I think no one's going to disagree that Acts was the birth of the church. Pretty much the rest of the New Testament was the cleanup of the messiness of the book of Acts, which a lot of times we forget that, you know, all the epistles are written because of the messiness of ministry. And so when you have, and it's kind of like, you know, so many analogies to the family, which, by the way, I'll just take a rabbit trail. It's just interesting that when you look at the biblical qualifications for a pastor, it's not his theology, although that's very important. It's not his leadership skills, although that's very important. But the foundational base is always, you know, can you conduct a family? Mm-hmm. And why is that? Because throughout the whole New Testament, it's family driven, and so many things. But anyways, back to you, back to your question with that. But in the book of Acts, it's the birth of the church. And in that birth of the church, we see two very important delivery systems that are there. One is the temple courts that they knew about. That was not new news. That was a part of the Jewish tradition. But also was this the house-to-house movement of being able to say, you know, how does this play an active role that you see talked about in Acts 5, but modeled to us in Acts chapter 2. And throughout a very normative family process was built the counterweight to the temple courts. Now, however the house-to-house is played out, you know, is not as critical as that it actually does happen. And so you see throughout the church, the Great Commission and the Great Commandment, and throughout the house-to-house, the Great Commission and the Great Commandment is also part of that, that brings the accountability. It brings, you know, I love, you know, Rick's quote in the foreword of the book. I mean, it's his very, very first line that kind of sums up everything. But, you know, he talks about how small groups are the heart of Saddleback. They're the sources of our church's health and growth, which is, you know, that sets the stage. But then it says small groups are the center of our discipleship. We don't have a separate discipleship model. We do it relationally through our small groups. It's the structure of our ministry, which is where we help people take that crawl, walk, run to say, where am I going to get involved in the church? Because so often the church needs people to run, but then we grab people who are just walking because we need a body real quick instead of being strategic there. It goes on to say it's the launch pad of our evangelism. We don't have a separate evangelism program because we want it done relationally through our small groups. It's the enrichment of our worship. And when you start to read through the book and understand Saddleback, you know, Rick wrote Purpose Driven Church in 1995. This is probably the counterpart to that in 2011. Almost 15, 16 years later. But you'll notice that worship is fleshed out a lot more from the standpoint that it's about, you know, what are you going to sacrifice? And it's the network of our fellowship. So it's biblical in the standpoint that throughout the first, you know, 300 years till Constantine legalized the church, it was the only delivery system. Temple culture was actually way out of whack. But then you see once the church get legalized, the pendulum swings back the other way. And then everything was about the church because it was so new. And then the small groups, you know, kind of took a little bit of a backseat. So it's about having a balance of both delivery systems. That's why, for me personally, both are very, very important to the corporate structure of, you know, how Christ gave us the church and for people to live healthy and balanced lives. That's why a lot of times people will... unless, you know, the government is so oppressive to you, it's hard to do a corporate gathering, but it's still very, very important.
Well, you take this to a deeper level, helping us to understand the issue of relationship. When you talk about, and you say in your book, as a leader, it's your job to help the people of your church tune into the harassed and helpless of today to share Jesus' vision of a shepherd for every person. If your heart isn't invested in your people, don't expect them to invest their heart as well. We were doing the small group training where you were doing it at Radicalis this spring. And probably for the first time in many years as a seasoned pastor, I was actually numbed with shock and awe by something you did, and I have repented of my sin as a result of it. And for our listeners, I think it's very valuable if they could hear a portion of that. In your training, you have recently moved from the house that you were at for quite some time, mm-hmm. and then you moved into a new neighborhood, and we didn't know that as you went through this process.
Yeah.
I'm not going to ask you to go through the whole process, but why don't you share with our listeners, pick a neighborhood, either one, mm-hmm. Because he did this twice for our listeners. He did this twice, and that's probably why I am still repenting of this sin, mm-hmm. of not actually having that deep relational aspect that I want, that you model so well, that this book is attempting to achieve, to help leaders, hosts, to really grasp the whole concept of what I believe New Testament church is all about. The worship, of course, the temple courts. We've got that one down pretty good across mm-hmm. America. But we miss this dynamic that this book, the small groups book, does. So talk to us a little bit about your neighborhood.
Yeah. You know, and I think, Matt, what you're bringing across is the whole it's an evangelistic piece of that. But where it originated from, or, you know, its conception happened when I had one of those John 21 experiences with God, you know, in John 21, where he asked Peter, "Do you love my sheep?" And he says, "Yes, I do, Lord." And he goes, "Well, feed them." And he asked him three times, and there's, you know, many, many reasons why that whole chapter gets unpacked the way it does. But what I'm referring to is more just the repetitiveness, because when both of my children were young, still not followers of Christ yet, it was one of those things where as a parent, I prayed for their salvation every day religiously. And it was one of those times where I felt God talking to me in my quiet time one time, just saying about, "Hey, do you want your kids to go to heaven?" It was like one of those, "Yeah, of course I want my children to go to heaven," you know. And it's like, you know, I just felt it was prompting in, "Do you really want them to go to heaven?" I'm like, "Going, God, I really want them to go to heaven." And it's like, you know, "Do you really, really want to go to heaven?" I go, "I lay down my life." Literally, I could sign a document right now and, you know, you take my life, but guarantee them in heaven, I would do it right now, because that's what it's about. I'd rather spend eternity with them than, you know, 70, 80 years here on this planet. Actually, you know, subtract that out, because we had them late in life. So, you know, it's probably like 40 years on this planet, 50 years. And it kind of originated out of that, because my sucker punch was, you know, God is saying, "Do you love the people that I have around you as much as you love your children?" And it was such a heartfelt blow that it forced me to make a decision in that point. Of course, at that point, I wanted to go more Calvinist and say, "Hey, you know, some are destined to go to hell. So, you know, I'll just leave that with you, God." But there was a piece of it where God really challenged me to say, "You know, learn to cross the street before you cross the sea." Mm-hmm. And it was one of those pieces in my own life of just saying, you know, how do I do that now? With the one neighborhood, people can say, "Well, you know that, you know, y'all had young kids, and there was a lot of kids on that." But what was interesting is, you know, I moved to another neighborhood, and I can remember meeting my first neighbor, and he says, "Hey, we're kind of a quiet cul-de-sac, and it's a little bit more older and stuff like that." And they said, "You kind of won't get what you had at your last cul-de-sac, so just be prepared for that." So it took a lot more effort to get to know people, in all honesty. It took a little bit more effort to, you know, get the mail the same time they did, or when I saw them, say hi to them. Because it forces them to want to say hi too, because I'm, you know, I'm tenacious enough to say, you know, when I say hi, you know, if they don't say hi back, I'll say, "Oh, I'm sorry, I was trying to say hi to you, and what's your name?" So at my one neighborhood, the welcome wagon came. At another neighborhood, it was, you know, it was taken out by the Taliban or something. Literally, we came and we did our welcome to the neighborhood, and so we got to know our neighbors, and for some of them, we brought things and things like that. We just did the reverse to it. And I've gotten to know just about all of them on the second neighborhood. Now, I've only been there just a little over a year, but I've already had an opportunity through a relationship just to ask people to, you know, come to church. And some of them said they've been involved in a church, which is good, and things like that. But the thing I've learned at the last cul-de-sac I was at is that, you know, as you help people discover and become a follower of Christ, is that it's more about just being you. It's not being... Their concept of a Christian is somebody that's on TV and screaming at them and telling them what not to do. Mm-hmm. But when you can partner alongside them with what you both like to do, It's a step in the right direction. So don't know if that answers your question. But
give us an example. You took us around house by house by house, and you took us through dad, mom, every child, animals in the house. I was blown away by that. And you told us not only their names, but what's going on, where they are in their life, where they are at school, which most, to be honest, most senior pastors in smaller churches don't even know all those details of a core of their people. Just give us an example, maybe from your old neighborhood.
Yeah, and a part of that is just because you and don't think that I'm just, you know, got a steel mind trap. I literally drew it out. So at my old neighborhood, there were 16 homes on our cul-de-sac. We owned one of them, and so there's 15 others. And so I kept a sheet of paper with everybody's name, and as I got to meet them, I'd come back to that, and I would write down what I found out about them so that the next time when I talked to them, they'd be blown away about, you know, what I did. The same thing with my new neighborhood. On my cell phone, I just kept a text with me with each person's name, and I'd put question mark for a house if I didn't know it. And once I was talking to a neighbor, or, you know, I was, oh my goodness, I'm terrible on first names. You know, so I'd write it down and they would totally understand that. So, you know, first or last, but I'll just go with the current one at my new neighborhood. You know, there's a boy that my son plays with and his name is Kyle. And, you know, I got to meet his parents, Kim is one of them, and Mike's the other one. And so have started to just get a relationship with them. I remember when I met them, and the first time is very standoffish. Well, then I found somebody else moved in. They were living with another family in there, is Jay and Junanne. And so when I had a birthday party, you know, at that time, is new on the cul-de-sac. I invited the whole cul-de-sac to my birthday party. Because I knew they would want to see you inside the house because they want to see what happened. But B, it gave me an opportunity. Now, they didn't know me from Adam, so I got lots of cigars and lots of bottles of wine, which I don't use both of. But the same, what it was, they were bringing their tokens of what they valued. And so I've gotten to know all five of them in a deeper way. And, you know, through an opportunity, Mike's gotten laid off recently and had an opportunity to just talk with him about building that and just building a relationship. And, you know, Lisa was able to invite them to our Easter service. They politely declined, which is fine. And so we start with that. But
You can do that all the way around your cul-de-sac, your neighborhood, and what impressed me was you did that all the way around the first neighborhood, but you did that, and then it must have been, because we're 3 months down the road now, that was 7, 8, 9 months into being in your new neighborhood, and you were already in the process of doing that all the way around again.
Yeah. Let me just give you a classic example, because you know, at this newer neighborhood where there's only two families with young children. So it makes, you know, those relational ties together. You know, when Jesus was at the well, he found common ground for he and the woman. And that was, they were both wanted water. And so he was able to strike up a conversation. Well, it was just, you know, one of those things where three doors down, a guy named Alan, single parent, a single guy, probably divorced 10, 12 years ago. I noticed that his dog had a collar around it. And so I just, you know, asked him about his dog. And he lit up. People love to talk about what's closest to them. So he told me all about his dog. Now, did I have, you know, was I that interested? You know, I've had dogs before, but I found out, you know, he had dogs that I had. So he had a lab and I've had labs. And so, and then this one was a Rottweiler that was being worked on, but we had some commonalities there. And then, at that time he noticed I had a bandage on my nose cause I had some skin cancer, which is part of being in Southern California. And he goes, I've had that too. And somehow we got talking about my son and he had an ingrown toenail. And I said, you know, bad genes on my side of the family because I had three. And he goes, well, I've had three. So, you know, all of a sudden now Alan and I have some common ground so that, you know, eventually we can build that. Now, that's the planting of the seed. So I'm like, last cul-de-sac, I led five families to the Lord, but I lived there 12 years. And I've had opportunity to plant seeds. And I've had just as much rejection as I've had success. But the point is one of the guys I led my last cul-de-sac, he said a powerful statement to me in Starbucks when he accepted Christ. He goes, if I would have done what you'd been talking to me about the last 5 years, I wouldn't be in this mess. Mm-hmm. And I say that because the powerful statement right there, he says, if I'd only done what you told me to do the last 5 years, he knew what I was challenging him to do. But he had to have a crisis for him to say, oh, okay, I want to do it. Now, fast forward 3 years later, he's helping at Saddleback and he's very entrenched. It cost him a marriage. But what you don't want to be is when you're helping somebody in a crisis, you don't want to have them say, I wish you would have shared with me mm-hmm. 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. So there's just that piece of it that you want to do what you can. Now, you do it relationally. I mean, I'm not going to go up to Alan and say, hey, do you want to know Jesus? Because he doesn't even know who I am yet. Mm-hmm. So it's a relational process.
And one of the reasons I had you share that is that it's central to the issue of small groups. Mm-hmm. And the issue of small groups really comes down to, you talk about the difference between fellowship and evangelism and how small groups, when you have Christians together, they tend to move towards fellowship instead of evangelism. But in reality, with the illustration you've just shared and what you talk about in the book over and over again, is that fellowship is just a bridge for evangelism if you think more about how much you care about the people around you. Yeah. It's a shepherding issue.
Yeah, and in essence what you're doing, and Rick was the one who taught me this, is you're building a bridge so Jesus can walk across. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's with people that are very different than you, theologically, morality-wise, you know, how they live out their sexuality, how they do stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's important for us to realize that Jesus hung around with those very people, so it is one of those slow processes. Sometimes the bridge is built quick. Sometimes it's built very, very slow. But in the essence, in evangelism, you know, in small groups, as you read in the evangelism chapter, we're more concerned, the principles of evangelism. Some churches do rapid cell multiplication over in other parts of the planet. I just found here that doesn't work. It doesn't mean that the principle is any less valuable to us. We just have to figure out a different methodology for it. So we hold personal evangelism higher to people so that they're doing that versus rapid cell multiplication for our evangelism strategy.
Let's talk a little bit about that strategy. One of the things that has really come to the fore, which most of America is familiar with, is the campaign and how you work that into the process of small groups. Let's talk a little bit about strategic use and multiplying of small groups at Saddleback through the campaign.
Yeah, and when you say multiplying of groups, it's more, there's a whole strategy in there. So verbally, I'm trying to give you what the whole chapter.
Well, that's why you buy the book.
Oh.
I'm just letting you get just a little touch.
Yeah, but what you're trying to do is you're trying to bring alignment. A campaign is something we do once a year, trying to bring the five ways that people learn, give them each one a valuable opportunity to learn a soul theme so that they can take that theme or whatever the compelling question is deeper in their small group. We do it for 40 days, so it's a short-term involvement. We have a host acrostic. You know, if you have a heart for people, if you're willing to open up your place, can you serve a snack, and can you turn on a DVD player, you can host a group. It's very early on in our discipleship pathway, but it's like when Jesus said to the disciples, hey, follow me. You know, he was doing the host strategy.
And there's a lot of debate these days about when did the disciples actually come to faith in Christ, because they kept asking the question, or kept making the statement, excuse me, they kept saying, and now we believe. But if you do that chronologically through a harmony of the Gospels, you realize that got a little discouraging if you were Jesus, because it kept coming up time and time and time again as he got closer and closer to leaving. So we understand the strategy is very biblical. It's very, and Jesus modeled it.
Yeah, and it's through that sanctification that you can, you know, ask the disciples to do more, which, you know, in the course of 3 years, they're willing to give their lives. Mm-hmm. But in the campaign, what we're trying to do is when you have a light that is very lighting up a lot of area, it's not as powerful. But when you bring alignment to children's, student, and adult ministries in your church, for 40 days, focusing on a thing, stopping a lot of good programs for 40 days so that you have one good program happen, the strategy is just irreplaceable to how what it's done with our small groups. And what it's done is it's helped people to take a step, have permission not to continue a step, but also with some, they're willing to continue to take a step with you and grow in their spiritual formation. So it's a very powerful tool. And the reason why, we're so important to have that, because, you know, in our small groups, our groups go for life. But we use campaigns to give people an out so that if their group isn't going well, then they can go start a new one with other friends. And sometimes that's just because their group didn't work for them. Sometimes it's because in the seasons of life, when your children get older and they start to get new friends because of, you know, their affinities that they're getting involved in, whether it's sports or dance or academics or whatever it is, it's going to pull you to other friendships or other parents. And so God may be leading you to start a new group. So we give our people in our small groups a chance to go out and start a new group with other friends if they have it. But on the small group side, there's the campaign side, that's the whole church side. But on the small groups element of that, what we're trying to do is give people the power, give people the gift of hospitality, the power to lead a group using their giftedness, but at the same time keeping the doctrine safe because of the DVD curriculum.
Now, probably one of the most exciting things is when Saddleback started thinking out of the box from even what they were doing, and began to talk about other places to have small groups, for example, in the workplace. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about how that kind of took off and what kind of ideas that birthed.
Yeah, I mean, really, one of the things, you know, like I said, I've been here for 14 years, and for once we started doing the campaigns in 2002, we started to saturate a lot of our people with that strategy. And it was a place of just saying, you know, God, is there, you know, in mining, you mine a vein till you can get all you can out of it. And was there other veins that are in our Saddleback Mountains that we could go after? And one of them was the work environment, of being able to challenge people, hey, wherever you work, would you be willing to start a small group? Again, pushing out the comfort zones of our people. And so we have a workplace ministry that has about, you know, 600 groups that are challenging people either before work or during lunch or after work to take their faith a step forward. So we're ministering to them that way. Another vein that is just starting is our online groups, which is, again, you know, we have internet campuses in a lot of our churches. Well, this is the discipleship front. So we're probably one of the first churches having a discipleship arm via the internet. It's not just the chat rooms, you know, before and after the service for you to talk about, but it's an online group. And so right now we have about 68 of those, with just under 700 people in them. So you can't negate where people are at. Now, to be honest with you, I don't know. Is the internet campus and the online group, you know, the equivalent of Acts 5:42? I don't know yet. We're still on the front edge of trying to learn.
That's
those.
For a book in about 5 to 10 years, right?
Yeah, you know, and it very well could be. But the thing that we can't ignore is that in 98, I met with a secular company that was doing a network of chat rooms. And at that time, they would have 1.2 million people in their chat rooms. This was 1999. That's a long time ago. Well, I've had the privilege to talk with Scott Hefferman with Meetup.com, who's got the same thing rolling. And for him, he is got 7.2 million people
Wow.
in their meetup groups. Now, those are staggering numbers, and there's not a church on the planet that has that. But it just shows you that I'm not a chat room type of person or an online type of person to that degree. I enjoy people, but there are a number of millions of people that do that. If you look at World of Warcraft, there's hundreds of thousands of people paying $10 a month to be part of that network. So there's a lot of terrain that's out there, and there's not real solid answers, but it's, you know, tipping the church over a little bit of, you know, What's the next ecclesiastical piece of what does that mean for the church?
Because everything's driven back to, we'll go back to your neighborhood. Everything's driven about caring for people. Everything's driven about, I really do care about my neighbor. I really do care about the people inside my congregation, whether that's my small group or if I'm the pastor. Now I'm talking to you, pastor. This book is one of the most valuable books you're going to put on your shelf. After 30 years of ministry and a lot of theory about small groups, you're going to get information that has been banged through the trenches and tossed all the things that don't work at all. They've been tossed, and these are tried and true things. They might not work for you, but the principles are all there. And so you're going to have illustrations of the principles, and the principles are going to be the things that are going to be the great value. See, we could cover lots more. This is an exciting book, but I probably missed something you'd like to say before we wrap this up. Let me just give you an opportunity to say that.
Yeah, I think clearly if I shot my one bullet, it would be, don't do ministry alone. I have the privilege of having a staff. I can remember when I didn't have that privilege. But the point is that the enemy operates off isolation and fear. And one of the things I want to take away from the enemy for you is the isolation piece. We have a small group network that is free. Small group network.com. It's done by people in the trenches. It's all volunteer, so it doesn't look real sexy on the website and things like that, but people are doing their best. But what I would say to you is that wherever you live, because we just opened up an international arm to it too, so wherever you're at on the planet, we're trying to make sure that nobody does ministry alone. So nobody stands alone. And I would say to you, if I could say anything, the book is wonderful, but if you're doing it in isolation, it's only a matter of time before you get picked off. And so it's important to have people that are doing the same type of ministry as you in your local area that you can just team up with, two, three times a year. But somebody in a crisis, when you think you're going crazy, you just want to be able to call them up and say, am I going crazy? And they'll probably say, I'm dealing with the same thing. So I would just challenge you to go to smallgroupnetwork.com and sign up for it. Again, it doesn't cost anything, and all it is a more or less just a matchmaking service of trying to get people in that same area. And the other thing I would say is just to be able to challenge you just educationally is we have an online conference coming up called The 12, September 14 and 15, and you can go to smallgroups.net. That's smallgroupsplural.net/12. You can spell it or put the numbers in. You'll get to the same place. But I encourage you on that. It's an opportunity for you to learn no matter where you're at and take away the hotel and the flights and pretty much the registration. It's just about dirt cheap right now.
The only thing you don't get is the beautiful Southern California weather.
That is true. But you can always come to our campus here whenever you want. But if you can't, that's a great alternative for you.
Well, thanks for the investment. Those of you who are in Africa and those of you who are in India and those of you who are in the Philippines and in Micronesia, you've heard now that this network is available to you as well. We have notes in the show notes. We have information and links for that as well. I want to make sure that you take advantage of that. Now, Mike, why don't you take a minute and tell us how to get a copy of Small Groups with Purpose and the information on Steve's ministry and the leadership help he wants to give to small groups.
I sure will, Matt. You can also learn more about Steve's ministry by clicking the link provided in the show notes as well. Matt encourages you to pick up a copy of Steve's book, Small Groups with Purpose. This is a great resource from a great man of God, and you can find out more about the book and how to purchase a copy in the show notes. And now, until next time, I'm your host, Mike Powers, wishing you the favor of God as you serve Him for His glory.